everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Laura Holmans, and I'm here today with film critic Hugo Emerzel.
Hey, what's up, everybody?
If you want to support our work, please leave a review and share this podcast with your friends. We're going to be talking about two new releases, Josh Safdie's Ping Pong Saga, Marty Supreme, and Emerald Fennell's quote-unquote Wuthering Heights. What connects these two is that they are talked about a lot online. Both these movies managed to nail their guerrilla marketing campaigns in very different ways. So in addition to reviewing these two movies, we're also going to be looking at some interesting movie marketing campaigns. But first, some fun things going on here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam. If you like No Other Choice, we're screening some other Park Chan-wook movies so you can catch up on his earlier work. We're also going to be screening one of my personal favorites, Singin' in the Rain. And also ongoing is our Brazil Beneath the Surface program. You can find our full program at lab111.nl. Hugo, what's new? What have you been watching? What have you been up to?
I'm doing great. I recently did the International Film Festival Rotterdam, but not really in Rotterdam, but more in Groningen, city up north in the Netherlands. They do a satellite program. It was nice, and the highlight was that I did the intro before Sirat, which is also playing here in Lab 111, but it's a film that has a very strong club music soundtrack. We actually have an interview coming up with the composer, Candin Ray. And so in honor of this like very fierce techno that's in the film, we had decided that I would do a mini DJ set before the film was played.
Ooh, fun.
And it was actually, it can sound cringe to do this in the cinema, but it was actually very sick because they had great speakers, technology, beautiful projection and lights and stuff. So it actually worked and people were, I think, very hyped to have that first and then immerse themselves in this like crazy experience of a film. So that was super sick. And also in terms of watching, tonight I'm giving a lecture in Rotterdam on the cinema of Ann Lee prior to a screening of Brokeback Mountain. So I rewatched it. And I'm happy to report it's still a banger. It still holds up.
Yeah.
It deserved the Oscars and the praise. It sounds like a film that was so, you know, praised and loved that you can take it easily for granted. But it was actually very sick. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, same. Last week's episode is all about Brokeback Mountain and queer identities. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, I highly recommend it.
Me too. And how about you, Laura? What's new?
Oh, not a lot. I've just been like watching a lot of stuff. I feel like my letterbox tells me we're February 10th recording this. And I've watched like 60 something movies already this year.
Good
so
job.
It's just been a lot of like watching stuff.
What's a recent highlight?
I have to say I've also been watching a lot of like Olsen Twins movies and like bad rom-coms, because I think one of my favorite things is to watch a movie like Sweet Home Alabama and then just like complain about it the whole time. And then the other day I watched The Great Gatsby by Baz Luhrmann, which... I was so confused because I went on Letterboxd to see what like my friends thought of it. And there's such a like a huge ratio of like people gave it like 5 stars, 4 stars, 1 star, 2 stars. And I kind of fall more on the like lower end
Me
of
too.
It because I think there's just such a unique brand of cringe to Baz Luhrmann. And it's so incredibly overstimulating. So like I think in the first act, he cuts every second.
Yes.
I started counting. I started like pointing it out to my partner going like, see, 1, 2, 3. Like he can't keep the camera still. He always wants to zoom in on every single fucking thing. Just keep the camera still for once. And then something that aged very cringely is that he throws these amazing parties, and they're parties that you are supposed to want to go to. And they look amazing. There's a pool in the center of the room and everyone's having a great time. They're playing Black Eyed Peas.
Let's get like, started.
Like, how did you think that was going to age well? I thought it was so incredibly cringy. It's not like a 1 star for me because I do think like Leonardo DiCaprio does a great performance as he does in kind of everything. But yeah, I think that's one that kind of stood out to me.
For me, this film is mega cringe as well, but everything that makes it cringe when you watch Elvis, which is a film that I love very much, Ovid is actually genius. So it's like the cringe to genius potentiality.
What's the difference for you?
It's just, I think the focus on the axis of the subject matter and it actually, the form actually complements the story and the character. And suddenly I'm like this feverish maniac kind of like ride that he throws you on. it fits the Elvis mindset and the entire mindset of America around that time. And then I'm like, yes, let's go. Give me more, even more. It's great. But yeah, I totally agree that like there's a huge potential for awful cringe in the Baz Luhrmann film.
I mean, with Elvis, I almost walked out of that movie in the first act because I was just like, he does. Apparently in his first act, things have to be very overstimulating. I don't do well with that. So I think in the first like 15 minutes of Elvis, when it basically just looks like a music video and it's all like cut together. Yeah. And I was like, do I really want to do this?
This like this meme, you know, what Baz Luhrmann does in my house when I'm already overstimulated.
Right, like, right. It's absolutely that. So maybe he's just not for me. I am excited to revisit Romeo plus Juliet. That's now screening at Lab as well. Because I remember liking that as a kid, but I think that was mostly because Leonardo DiCaprio was at like peak attractiveness and I was 12.
You're about to find out. I haven't seen it in a long time.
Same.
Well, but speaking of overstimulating, I think it's a good segue to the, let's say, media saturation of two films that have dominated the social media feeds.
Absolutely. So Wuthering Heights is Emerald Fennell's take on the Emily Brontë novel of the same name. However, she keeps stressing in interviews, it's in quotation marks, so it's really just a take on it. So we have Heathcliff, played by Jacob Elordi, who grows up as a poor outsider taken in by Kathy's dad, and Kathy is Margot Robbie. They grow up together and their bond is strong and kind of bordering on obsessive. However, Heathcliff doesn't have status, so Kathy chooses to marry the wealthy neighbor for financial security. Heathcliff hears the news, is mad, he fucks off on horseback, and he returns years later, rich, bitter, with a fresh haircut, and ready to take revenge on everyone surrounding this lifelong situationship.
He did a glow up.
Here's a clip.
What should you do, Heathcliff?
What?
If you were rich?
Suppose I'd do what all rich men do. I'd live in a big house. And be cruel to my servants. Take a wife.
A wife? What wife?
I have to say, I kind of went in so ready to hate this because her previous two movies, Emerald Fennell's previous two movies, were not for me.
Promising Young Woman and Saltburn.
Promising Young Woman, I thought, started off really strong. It had a very promising kind of like setup.
Promising Young
setup. And I think it just like shat the bed in the third act and I thought it was terrible. And Saltburn was in a way entertaining and it all looks really good. But the thing that pissed me off about Saltburn is that it's so clearly just a copy paste of The Talented Mr. Ripley. Like it really just is.
Yes.
And if we can just accept that, then that would have almost been fine. However, Emerald Fennell goes around in an interview saying, don't see it. Don't see it. Never came up. Like that never, like I've never thought of that.
That cracks me up so much. It's so blatant. But to be honest, I thought Saltburn was genius because of its blatantness. I love this film. I think it's like a 4.5 to 5 star
movie. That is
movie.
An insane take.
Yes, I know. And you know, I didn't watch Saltburn when it came out, and it was this huge scandal film because it has this, like, a promiscuity,
penis.
Like, it has a lot of, like, quote-unquote, again, explicit sex stuff in it, so people were shocked on social media. And I was like, I don't want to be shocked, I don't want to, like, it's too much. This talking about saturation of the marketing and stuff. So I immediately checked out, never watched it, and then my girlfriend said, wait a minute, it's actually good, let's watch it. And I'm watching it, and I'm like, yes, you're right, this is hilarious, it's genius, it's very funny, it's very nasty, everybody's just such a scheming bitch, and I enjoyed it very much. And then the blatantlessness and the lack of originality are almost like a selling point to me, because it just makes it even more evil. And I love evil movies, we know this, we have established this. So I'm now with Wuthering Heights, I'm actually genuinely like the opposite of you. I am excited. Okay. But I'm also, of course, apprehensive because I'm seeing all of these mixed reactions. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a bit about this viewing experience for you, what the film was doing or not doing?
Yeah, so I fully was ready to hate it because before even anything about this movie was known, the casting was announced.
Yeah.
And the casting was announced and it caused so much outrage on the internet because Heathcliff in the book is clearly described as a person of color. There's, I'll just pull up some things that it says in the book. It's like, he's described as a dark-skinned gypsy. It's speculated that his mother might be an Indian princess. And he, in the book, expresses like, I wish I was fair-skinned. Like, this is, it's really hard being a dark-skinned person, even though it's never said whether he's like Romani or Indian or could have been in those days in England. And then Kathy in the book is a teenager. And then Margot Robbie is not a teenager. She's in her mid-30s.
Really?
So, and she's gorgeous and she's great. But like, so that caused a lot of outrage online. I think it's one of those interesting race swap things that she did, because basically Mr. Linton, the rich man that Kathy marries, Mr. Linton, he's played by Shahzad Latif, who's a British Pakistani actor who is incredibly handsome, but he's clearly been asked to like gain some weight for the role and look kind of unappealing, as opposed to like Jacob Elordi, who's like 9 feet tall and like... So it's one of those race swaps that to me feels like a privileged person going, I don't see color, but it kind of makes it worse because Mr. Linton is kind of framed to be like marrying him is like a fate worse than death because she loves Heathcliff. And like, so why is that person now a person of color? And the person that would have narratively made so much sense to be a person of color is now just like a white guy.
Yeah, it kind of fucks its own like undergirding of what makes this romance so challenging and multifaceted and layered. But I also want to be immediately, and again, I haven't seen it, the advocate's devil. If the film is fun and good, who cares, right? So is it fun and good?
So yeah, I have to admit, I really enjoyed it. I thought it looked incredible. All of the, basically, the set design, the cinematography, the costumes, they're all amazing. The score is really great. Yeah, I kind of have to admit that I went in closed-minded and it kind of won me over. It's not a 4 or a 5 star for me, but I would say like maybe a 3.5 because it was just enjoyable enough. Despite all the problems I have with it, I was into it and it works.
And one more very important question. Is it horny? Is it nice?
Oh, it's horny as hell.
Is the horniness good? Because also talking about the cringe to genius, you know, scale that we've now established, Fennel's always somewhere like, you know, ping-ponging between the two, oscillating. And is this good horny or is it cringe horny?
No, it's very like female gaze, which I think is important to have in movies. I think now we are seeing basically the market realize that, oh, maybe like female horniness is something we should be catering to. And it is a lot of like him like holding her really tight. Or there's like this one scene that I think is also in the trailer where he like, she has this corset on and he kind of like pulls her up by the corsets. A lot of those
it's
things.
A lot of this like things that you now have in this erotic literature booming trend that's been consumed a lot, right?
Yeah.
This kind of like very physical, sensorial kind of like emphasis on tiny aspects of eroticism.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I would say it is horny, but it's not that like sexual. There's not like a lot of like fucking, but there's a lot of those yearning. There's a lot of yearning in it, and it's
gestural instead of explicit.
Exactly.
So Hugo, you say you're not too bothered about the race swap, which for me, it depends on the context, but so like with Saltburn, you don't mind that it's quite blatant ripping off the talented Mr. Ripley. Not that it matters, but more like, if in this sense, why does Emerald Fennel need to call it Wuthering Heights? Why can't it just be something else of like her own take without it being Wuthering Heights?
Well, it's a good question. It gets into the marketing thing as well. I guess it's like, why not to call it Wuthering Heights, and also why not to steal of other people and to change things? I do very much understand this need for correct, quote unquote, representation. But as a reason a priori to not want to see the film or to be very critical of the film, for me, also doesn't make sense, because then you have to ask, what do we even want from Emerald Fennel? And at this point, it's very clear that she's a somewhat idiotic, evil director. And And then, like, I guess I am just more interested in taking that at face value and to not go there to have, let's say, an intellectually correct experience, but right. just to have some blatant, juicy, like, high goss kind of experience.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about this kind of race swap as well is, like, of course, there's been a ton of race swap things where, for example, I think The Little Mermaid is a really famous example
yeah.
where in the live action one, she's played by Halle Bailey, who's a black girl. Her dad is Javier Bardem, who is Spanish. And, like, but in that case, it just, like, adds to representation. Like, young girls needed a thing like that. In this case, I think it removes representation because I think it would have been an amazing opportunity to have someone like Dev Patel or yeah, like
I was
someone
also thinking about
or
like
someone
him,
yeah. that we don't know yet to be in this huge like IP that's, by the way, in the public domain. Because so if you want to
yeah,
make your own Wuthering Heights movie,
movie,
you don't
please,
have to like buy the rights for it. I
please
think
go.
So I think this would have been an incredible opportunity to put someone in an attractive male lead role where it really matters to the story, because now all that is keeping them from being apart is that he's not wealthy. Mm-hmm. And in the book, what's keeping them apart is like they're not allowed to be together because he's a person
and
of
this
color.
Is and this is kind of what I like, because it's like Saltburn is also just only about class, but in a very dumb way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like she's good at taking the big theme and then being very idiotic about it, but the theme is like addressed as if it's big enough to put everything in motion, the entire plot.
Does it make a difference to you that Emerald Fennell comes from a very privileged, rich
exactly,
background?
No, yeah. but that's like, no, it actually makes it better. You know, it's like, that's the mindset. That's how our brain works. And then these films, I think, are an honest, like, oblivious expression of that. And in that sense, for me, it's very transparent. I am not going to an Emerald Fennell film to have an accurate or correct time. I just want to see if she can still do some messy bitch stuff, basically.
Sure.
Yeah. And then I am curious. So you have two gigantuous stars. You have Jacob Elordi and you have Margot Robbie. Mm-hmm. Like, does the chemistry work?
In a way, so what I think is interesting about this whole thing that we're talking about marketing as well is I think the controversy added a lot to the marketing, because the reason everyone's talking about this is because people freaked out. And then Jacob Elordi and Margot Robbie, to me personally, jury's out whether or not Jacob Elordi's a great actor or if he's just tall. Like, I don't know if which of the two it is. Like, I have never seen him do anything exceptional, maybe. Margot Robbie is wonderful to look at. I think she's really great with like little micro expressions, and she's beautiful, of course. Their chemistry, hard to say. I think it doesn't work in what they're trying to do in this press tour.
Yeah, this is
so this
insane.
Press tour, for people who don't
my
know,
God.
Is they're kind of trying to mimic what happened.
Pamela Anderson and
well,
Liam Neeson.
Yeah, and even like a couple years before, you had Anyone But You, which was Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney, and they basically started this rumor that they like cheated on their partners with each other because their chemistry is just so off the charts. Like, people believed it because they actually believed that these two incredibly bland people would be attracted to each other.
Yeah, unseasoned chicken with rice.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the reason anyone talked about Anyone But You is because of the tabloid fodder. Yeah. Then Naked Gun happened, Pamela Anderson and Liam Neeson.
This one
kind of
this one hurt me a lot because I was like,
it
felt like, you know, hearing at a very late age that Santa doesn't exist. I was like, because yeah, Liam Neeson and Pamela Anderson, it also seemed that they hooked up and were like a genuine couple. And then after the fact, after the movie was released, it was just, oh no, by the way, it was just a stunt. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, but why? Everybody was like, yes, finally two like older stars as well can find romance.
Yeah,
and
we all were rooting for Pamela, man.
Yeah,
like, she's had such a rough go.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, it works really well for Naked Gun. So what I think, or what's very evident that they're trying to do on the Wuthering Heights press tour, is try to pretend that Jacob Elordi and Margot Robbie are like super into each other.
And it's insane because it's like they have similar rings that have an inscription of a bit of the book. There was like stories that Jacob Elordi would have like an altar
a shrine almost for Margot Robbie. It was like that they were so like that they had such a codependent relationship that they needed physically to hug each other and be with each other. And just like the list goes on and on of these tiny examples that I understand, because romantic and erotic obsession, it's strong, and yearning is huge.
But do you buy it between them?
No,
I don't.
And then I'm like, can we please stop? Because every day I'm opening Instagram and there's a new like variety interview.
Oh, Jacob Elordi holds up an umbrella to shield Margot Robbie from the rain at the Leicester Square premiere, and it's like, stop trying to make this happen.
Stop trying to make fetch happen, please. Like, no, honestly, like it's disturbing at some point, and it's sickly.
Yeah, but it works because we're here and we're talking about it. So, yeah, and then I am. Unfortunately, forced to admit that it was fun. And I saw it in IMAX, so they press screened it in IMAX, which is great. And it looks just delicious.
I'm hyped.
Cinematography, and I also want to shout out the lighting, because this is something I really complain about in a lot of modern movies, is everything's lit so incredibly flat. Boom, they really lit this movie. And I appreciate that.
And one more thing about the marketing thing, which is tangentially related, is that Charlie XCX did the album, the soundtrack album, right? And can we just say on the record that I am so fucking done with the entire Charlie XCX thing?
Fight
me. It is so much. And she's now like in every film.
She's
going to
be in seven
she's
movies
on Sundance with like four titles with this The Moment, which sounds like an awful like quasi faux documentary. This is Spinal Tap for the Brad era. And she is everywhere, and I don't buy anything about it anymore. Mm. It's just like her post-ironic, internet-savvy stance about authenticity in the cultural industry and then making a commentary on it, on the meta, but then actually not being authentic. And like this endless loop of fucking around with like farce and irony and authenticity, it's just frying my brain. I don't want to see her face for, like, there should be a mortuarium on Charlie XCX. So hard.
I disagree. I think she's fun, and I think she's having her moment. I'm actually looking forward to the moment. I think it could be very fun. One thing I want to say about the score is basically the original songs are by Charlie XCX, and some even by featuring John Cale from The Velvet Underground. The score is by Anthony Willis, and it kind of, like, it really mixes and it kind of meshes with each other, but it's really anachronistic, which is fun because we'll come back to that in Marty Supreme as well.
Yeah.
I love, and this is another controversy that happened around Wuthering Heights, like the costumes aren't period accurate. Yeah. Like she's wearing latex, she's wearing like, and it's, and it looks amazing. Like some of the set design, there's like a shiny red floor and this fireplace that has all these like plaster hands, and it almost reminds me of The Cook, the Thief, and The Wife and Her Lover.
As a stylist, she's quite baroque, and sometimes it results in some like exceptional shots.
Yeah, so speaking of anachronism, I think that's a good bridge to go to Marty Supreme. So, Marty Supreme by Josh Safdie stars Timothée Chalamet as a fast-talking shoe salesman in 1950s New York. Marty Mauser dreams of becoming a world champion table tennis player. When he comes across a faded Hollywood star played by Gwyneth Paltrow and her businessman husband played by Shark Tank's Kevin O'Leary, he sees a path to the one thing that stands between him and the championships, money. Marty is fearless and ambitious and willing to use anyone that can help him get to the top. Here's a clip.
Hello?
Hey, it's Marty Mauser. I'm in the royal suite. I saw you in the lobby yesterday.
Okay.
Well, I never talked to an actual movie star. You know, I'm something of a performer, too.
Are you?
Yeah, you don't believe me? You what? You what? You got the Daily Mail in front of you?
This is you.
Yeah, the chosen one. It's a nice picture, right?
I really enjoyed this movie.
Yes, I was already on the record here saying that it's insanely dope. I love the previous films that Josh Safdie did with his brother Benny, Uncut Gems and Good Times, which have a similar structure of a frantic...
I have called it like Uncut Gems but ping pong.
Yes, a psychotic, frantic, egomaniac protagonist scheming and running and stealing and robbing and lying his way to the top or to escape a certain doom in the previous ones. And I really like that here it's the, you know, the bravado of Marty Mauser
and his like unwavered belief in himself and his manifest destiny, I find this to be very endearing and cool. So yeah, it's an absolute banner.
I agree. And like with Timothée Chalamet, just to kind of touch on the marketing campaign before
I love
later
this.
In the episode.
I love Timothée's.
But the marketing campaign was so insane because yeah, he does. It starts with this Zoom call where he's like, first of all, he reveals that he shaved his head for Dune. So that was a headline. And then he's just talking about like what it can all be. And then there's a video with him and a blimp. And then he appears on the Sphere in Vegas and he does a rap song with SD Kid,
which is actually good. His rap was strong.
The lore of Timothée Chalamet has always been the little Timmy Tim thing. When he was back in school, he was already a rapper. The danger with a marketing campaign where he's so visible is oversaturation. Of course, like I feel it too. I went in going, man, I've been seeing a lot of Timothée Chalamet recently, but let's go. And then he just does this thing that I feel Leonardo DiCaprio also always does, is he just like wins me over immediately. He's such an incredibly
because he's having fun, because he's actually only doing the things like he's saying on his Zoom call that he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this was super cool, and it is a good meta extension of what the character is about. And now he's in this unique position where he's a very bankable star in a huge movie, he's vying for an Oscar maybe, and he can just get away with all of these things, and they're not that evil, you know? They're actually sweet and fun and endearing, silly, nerdy, but also it's kind of swagger, right?
Something I noticed with any Safdie movie so far is the casting is always incredible. Like, the faces that Josh Safdie in this, like, managed to collect. I mentioned in my intro Kevin O'Leary, who is an absolute fucking asshole.
Yeah, never forget, speaking of like intentional or unintentional marketing, that he was recently on stage with Donald Trump and Nicki Minaj.
Right. He's a huge like Trump supporter, Fox News. He's always spewing the most heinous shit.
But he works so well in the film as an evil man.
Yeah, so he works really well. And I was like, why would you give this man a platform? And Josh Safdie has said, it's like, I wanted to cast someone that when you see him on screen, you immediately hate him because you already have this history of hating him. Yeah. So I didn't have to like make the character hateable. So you see his face and you go, fuck that guy.
Yeah. Or there's another insane casting, and it's a bit of a side in the film, but it's a brilliant moment. There's an actor who actually played in Son of Saul, in, you know, the Auschwitz Holocaust film. And in this film, he is, and it's of course set in 1950s, he's a Holocaust survivor. Mm-hmm. And he gives an insane flashback anecdote that is a throwback to what happened in the 1940s.
Right.
But also this meta casting of to take an actor of one of the most serious Holocaust films of the last decades and to put him in a film that is essentially also kind of silly, but in a very genius way.
Yeah, that was such a weird scene. It's really great.
It's super, it's crazy. And like, I was watching this scene and I'm just like, no, they get away with it and it's so sick.
There's a couple more people I wanted to shout out is Luke Manley. That's his friend. He's kind of the bigger guy with the suspenders.
Yeah.
That is a complete unknown that Josh Safdie saw in like a viral online like street interview. Mm-hmm. And he's like, that's the guy. That's the guy I need. And then another amazing casting, I think, is Tyler, the Creator, who just has the best face and does a great job in this.
He's a good actor, actually. I was surprised. One anecdote, it's short, that I have about the Safdies is I interviewed them for A Good Time when it came out in Cannes. And it was very funny because we're doing the interview and Robert Pattinson is suddenly showing up and they're showing things on their phone and cracking up and this and that. But they were telling the story that for Good Time, for instance, they had friends in prison and that they would just wire them money or send them goods and stuff in exchange to have the access to their prison journals of like whom they met, characters they knew, people they encountered, stories that they collected, so they just always are putting these satellites out in orbit to try to get these fringe characters and stories. So they're very aware of how to get them and to put them in the film and to use them well.
Yeah, it's really unconventional. Someone I also want to shout out is Odessa Zion, who basically plays the female lead. She's one of those actresses that feels like she's suddenly everywhere.
Yeah.
She is maybe the most stunning creature I've ever seen in my life, but she, this is also one of her first like big roles in a feature film. And she also did She recorded her audition tape like really late at night in the middle of the night. And she just like did a scene from the movie in this phone booth. And I think she really nails it. I think one thing with Timothée Chalamet and Odessa Zion is that it's set in the 50s and they both kind of talk like LA or New York kids from like current times. And that's one of the first things I wrote down. It's like, you know, kind of like iPhone face, but for accent. But then I was like, yeah, okay. Is it important or is it just the fast talking nature? Like, would it sound weird if they had to focus on like saying it in a 1950s way where like people talked more like this? So first it kind of annoyed me and then it actually kind of worked for me because it can just be so naturalistic.
And the momentum is so big in the film. At the beginning, I was also wary, partially because of the cinematography and how it felt and looked for the first 10 minutes. I'm like,
what about it?
Felt a bit slick and clean. And at the beginning, I was like, is this the film that I'm going to watch? And then it just completely flips on itself. And all like every reservation that I had in the first 10 minutes just disappeared.
Yeah, and it does so many like creative little things. I wrote down two things. It was one is the Japanese news bulletin.
Yeah, so
when they talk about like there's this championship happening and they do this exposition in the form of this like news clip from Japan. And I thought that was incredible. And there's this scene that shows Marty Mauser like on his journey trying to get to the top. He does a lot of like halftime shows for basketball. Yeah. And there's this montage set to Everybody's Gonna Learn Sometime. And it's just these like beautiful, like super wacky situations. There's like a walrus and he's doing all these tricks.
Super farcical, some circus.
So absurd and so fun.
And that it's set to this particular song is very significant as well, because we're talking about the anachronism in Wuthering Heights. Mm-hmm. And this score is doing the same. You have these like pop banners of the 1980s. Forever young, I wanna be. And then you have this synthesizer score by one of Trix Point Naver, which he also did the previous Safdie Brother films. And it's so like consciously retro and futuristic at the same time. And this like, again, oscillating through the past, the present and the future constantly in the fabric of the film. It's very surprising to see a film that has such a good mastery of the flow of time. And yeah, this is definitely one of those.
And like, it's about ping pong and it's not about ping
pong. Yes, exactly.
But the moments that are about ping pong, I am so surprised how invested I can be in
so
table
cool.
tennis.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, it's shockingly well done. Yeah, so it's one of those weird films where if you would write everything out to a person that has never seen it, it would be like, what? And then you watch it and everything is there for a reason. It fits, it flows, it's natural. And yeah, it can just kind of wash over you in the best possible way, I think. So yeah, this is also one of my favorite films in the Oscar
Absolutely.
Discussion that we have now.
So we both highly recommend that one. So we talked about two movies with incredibly strong marketing for the current day. Whatever we think about it, it does seem to work. So I kind of want to go back in time and look at some other movies that had really strong marketing campaigns and that were a little bit unconventional. Okay. So one that I really remembered was The Blair Witch Project.
Oh, yes, of course.
You're also of that age,
yes.
I believe. So what the marketing did for The Blair Witch Project is it was the early days of internet. So it was 1999. We had all just got our personal computers. And basically, it's the first kind of like viral thing where it's like, did you hear? This movie's real. It's real footage. And it really happened. And it was such like a kind of like made us so curious.
And the website was like highly influential in that, because you can find all these bits of lore about this environment and its history. And this witch that is supposedly real and lives in the forest. And you can find the documents of like the 16th century and this and that. Like, they really did a good job that you can kind of rabbit hole by yourself on the internet. It was dope. Yeah. If you Google a little bit, you can still find this original website intact with the files.
Oh, cool. I will definitely check that out. One thing to mention also is that that movie had a 60K budget, which for people listening that don't know that that's not a lot of money at all. That is like an insanely low amount of money. And it made $250 million at the time at the box office. But it's also just a staple of like film history. And I'm sure it went on to make a lot more than that. One thing I also wanted to talk about is Steven Spielberg movies like Jaws and Jurassic Park. They both kind of did this strategy of, I think especially Jurassic Park, was just like, we're not even going to show you those damn dinosaurs. Yeah. Like, just trust us. So in the trailers and the marketing, they would do the shot of like Laura Dern taking her glasses off and being really shocked and the glass of water and just like the anticipation. And I think it worked really well. Like, the logo was everywhere. It was on toys. It was on t-shirts. So that is one of those things that I think is quite the opposite of what happens now. I feel like now we have trailers that give away every single thing that's in the movie that could possibly convince you to come see it in theaters. Trailers are sometimes like 4 minutes long. And I think I really miss the 30-second teaser trailer that shows me absolutely nothing. Just give me the vibe.
Get me excited.
Draw me in with anticipation. And then some other ones that had like alternate reality games. So The Dark Knight, I think Joker was one. And The Matrix is a really famous one where they kind of like had this thing where before the movie came out, you were trying to solve like what it was and what it was about. And these like cool like websites and... For The Dark Knight, there was a website where you could like solve riddles and crimes and get cryptic messages to like pretend that you're actually a citizen of Gotham trying to solve these things. I think those types of marketing things are way cuter than a PR relationship. And we'd be remiss not to mention Barbenheimer, of course, I think. So those two movies together, released in July 2023, made over $2.4 billion at the box office, which is absolutely insane. So what you see now is people try to recreate this. So in December, they're already trying to make Dune's Day happen, which is Dune Part 3 and Avengers Doomsday also come out on the same day, both in IMAX. I wonder how they're going to book those.
But it already doesn't work because you don't have the...
It's not opposites.
You don't like every good meme format is basically a binary thinking, right? It's like Drake, you know, yes, this is nice. No, this is not. It's always yes or no.
With Barbenheimer, it's like and inside you are two wolves.
Yes,
like.
Exactly. You see, but it's always a binary thing. It's schematic. This is what makes a meme very compelling because it helps us with our being a sorting machine. Our brains unpack and categorize things, and memes help us actually to criticize things with a much clearer lucidity than language sometimes can do. Yeah. And to me, if I hear this, I'm like, Avengers and Dune, I don't see how you can play with the difference between the two. There's nothing there.
I think meme-wise, there's nothing there. But also, the whole thing with Oppenheimer and Barbie is those are two movies that you can easily go see in the same day and not get bored because it was like, Oppenheimer is like the main course, Barbie's like the fun, vanilla milkshake that you get after. And I mean, we all know in this room, I fucking love Dune more than anything in this world. However, I can't imagine going to see Dune Part 3 and then still like having to be in the cinema for another 3.5 hours to watch Avengers Doomsday. I think that's going to be boring as hell. I think it's going to be long. I think it's going to be exhausting. So I really think it's cute that they're trying to make this happen. I just don't think it's going to do the same. It's not going to have the same cultural relevance. I'm sure it's going to make a fuck ton of money.
Sure.
But it's not going to have that moment of like Barbenheimer.
And I guess then maybe as a kind of conclusion, like the marketing campaign of a film can obscure that the film maybe is not that good. But usually if the film in itself just has enough elements that are good or interesting or genius to play with, then the marketing can come alive as well. And very often now, Hollywood, of course, is chasing it from the opposite perspective. Let's start with the marketing and then even think about the film. But if the film in itself, and, you know, at least with Wuthering Heights, I assume, but definitely with Marty Supreme, the films have things in it to sustain all this scrutiny and exposure. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes interesting, even if it can be annoying because it's so much on social media, it is at least interesting and it kind of works because maybe we will watch the films and we will learn that we actually don't hate Emerald Fennel, you know? So it's like it has a function.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how movies are currently marketed because I feel like now, instead of like, it is also a harder economy, like a harder attention economy to get your movie seen and to get people to go to theaters. So I don't know if the Jurassic Park strategy still works. So what you get now is, I think Wuthering Heights is a great example of that as well. You take existing IP and you build on that. So that's why you see a Barbie, after Barbie was a success, Hasbro sold the rights to Barney the Dinosaur, Uno, Hot Wheels, fucking like every single toy is now going to try and do Polly Pocket. Like everyone's going to try and do a big movie based on IP. We already had Minecraft. We already have like all of these other properties that then became a thing. And I wonder if we can ever go back to just hype. Like,
let's also not forget that the budget of a film, 50% of it now is dedicated to marketing.
Let me put it very bluntly. The day that I, in any professional capacity, have to watch an Uno film is the day that you can drag me behind the barn and literally shoot me like old Yeller, because the friendship is over. I will just have rabies and it will just be over. It will be so over.
Yeah. I agree. I wonder what that's going to look like. Is it people just pulling the reverse card on each other forever and ever?
Oh my God.
I don't even want to imagine what that is.
I'm already getting tired just thinking about that.
But also, apparently, the Barney the Dinosaur thing is like, it's going to be like produced or written by Daniel Kaluuya, and it's going to be like an elevated horror or something. And I'm like, I want out. I want out of this.
Just good times at the movies, please. Nice, nice, fun films that can be weird, can be shocking, can be a bit dumb as well, at least as they do something real. This is what we want. That's the best marketing. Word of mouth.
Absolutely. So Marty Supreme and Wuthering Heights are both screening here at Lab 111. You can find your tickets for that in the show notes or at lab111.nl.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.